Live from Washington, NPAC brings you gavel-to-gavel coverage of the House Judiciary Committee proceedings. Tonight, impeachment debate, July 24th, 1974. Here is NPAC correspondent Jim Lehrer.
Good evening. July 24, 1974. Another one of those days of history to save the front page of your newspaper to remember what you had for lunch. Because in a few moments, the House Judiciary Committee will begin its formal public debate and voting on articles of impeachment against President Richard Nixon. Only the second time in the nation's 200 years that any move against a president has gotten this far has been this serious. And if that wasn't enough in itself, it comes tonight in an atmosphere punctuated by a ruling earlier today from the U.S. Supreme Court ordering the president to turn over evidence to a federal district court. The vote by the High Court was 8-0. And just a few moments ago, President Nixon said through his attorney that he would comply fully with the Supreme Court's ruling to surrender 64 Watergate tapes and documents to Judge John Sirica here in Washington. James St. Clair read a statement from the Western White House saying that the president was, quote, of course, disappointed, end quote, with the court's ruling. But St. Clair read, quote, I respect the court and will comply in all respects, end quote. It all ties together. It is all interwoven. A momentum toward a climax of a fitful 2 years, which began when five men broke into an office building here in Washington called the Watergate.
I'm Paul Duke. Beginning tonight and continuing for the next several days, Jim and I in the PBS system will be bringing you gavel-to-gavel coverage of the historic proceedings now taking place before the House Judiciary Committee. In a way, this is the moment of truth for the 38 members of that committee. They have now heard the evidence, they have listened to the tapes, they have read the transcripts, they have questioned John Dean and the other witnesses. Now they must make their fateful decision. It's expected the committee will recommend impeachment, perhaps by a substantial margin. In the past few days, key members have been quietly meeting to draft language for at least two or more articles of impeachment. We, of course, do not know the form that the impeachment resolution will take, but the impeachment articles are expected to embrace at least three charges against the president: that he obstructed justice in the Watergate case, that he has widely abused his presidential authority, and that he has shown contempt for Congress by refusing to turn over evidence sought by the Judiciary Committee. Our Capitol Hill reporter, Carolyn Lewis, has been covering the committee's deliberations low these many months, and she is now standing by, waiting expectantly, outside the committee room. Carolyn, could you tell us precisely what the committee is going to do, how it's going to go about its business tonight?
Paul, the committee has set aside some 10 hours for debate, general debate, and we expect that they'll use up some three of those hours this evening. At the opening of the session, Chairman Peter Rodino will make a statement about 15 minutes long, and then he'll recognize the ranking Republican, Edward Hutchinson, who will make a statement of his own. During these opening hours, no member will be allowed to speak for longer than 15 minutes. Anyone who wants to use less time can yield the remainder to his colleagues. The plan is to recognize members in order of seniority, alternating Democrats and Republicans. Under the rules adopted last night, there could be some interruptions, with one congressman asking another to yield. On the whole, these early hours are likely to be very solemn, dealing with broad issues, with an overview, and very much formalized and structured. The idea here is to give each member of the Judiciary Committee his moment in the spotlight, his moment in court, so to speak, before getting down to the business of defining specific articles of impeachment. Jim?
All right, thank you, Carolyn. With Paul and me tonight to comment on the immediate as well as the long-range effects of what's happening in that committee room is the distinguished historian and author Barbara Tuchman. Mrs. Tuchman is the author of several books on recent world history, including The Guns of August and The Proud Tower. She has won two Pulitzer Prizes for her writings in history. Mrs. Tuchman, what are your thoughts as we prepare to embark on this Judiciary Committee debate? How would you classify it in terms of history?
Well, I think the first thing that that I'm thinking about is the opportunity for the House of Representatives and for the Congress to retrieve the role that the Constitution gave it and that has eroded so dangerously over the last 30 years. I think in a way, in a sense, it's the Congress that is as much, if not on trial, at least facing a serious moment in its history as much as the presidency. Because it seems to me that through its faults of omission over the last three decades, it is the Congress that has allowed the abuse of power by the presidency. And it's time we got it back. And I hope, I think the significance for the American people is in the action of the House, first of all, as much as what will happen in relation to the presidency.
Well, are you suggesting, rather subtly, Mrs. Tuchman, that you believe that this is a kind of last chance for Congress to stop the erosion of its own power and to impede the flow of power toward the White House, which has occurred in recent years?
Well, I'm not given to very dogmatic statements about first, last, and never. But I think it's a terribly important opportunity. And I have been, as an American citizen, concerned by the tipping of power in the executive, to the executive, for so long. Because I am not, I think like most of us, not an advocate of one-man rule, and our democratic system has been, I think, not through evil intent, but through circumstance, tipping way over toward one side in a way that has become dangerous for the outcome of democratic government.
Mrs. Tuchman, the assumption always is, of course, that a historian's eye is different than the layman's eye. What specifically are you going to be looking for tonight as you watch this debate? Any particular thing, just the words that you might hear or whatever?
Well, I was hoping to hear some statements of a sense by the committee that they represent the citizenry of this country, because after all, that's what a House of Representatives is. It represents the citizens. And I felt... I never lose my capacity to be shocked. I always thought I could. But I really was surprised, if not shocked, by the Republican statement of 2 days ago about, or was it yesterday, about Mr. Jenner and his not carrying out the functions for his client. Because I am really puzzled by the Republican by their equating the retention of Mr. Nixon in the presidency with the... Okay. Sorry.
Yeah. Well, let's go back to Carolyn Lewis for a moment, Ms.
Surely.
Tuchman. Of course, Ms. Tuchman will be with us throughout the evening when there are breaks and, of course, at the close of the program. Let's go to Carolyn Lewis for some reaction from the committee members to the president's decision a few moments ago. Carolyn?
Jim, the general reaction is a feeling of relief. I think that the president, by his action, has avoided what you might call instant impeachment. The feeling on the Hill, both in the Senate and the House, and that's very significant, was that if the president chose to defy the High Court, he would be instantly impeached. That, they all generally agreed, would be an impeachable offense. So the president has given them a feeling of relief. Now, the real question that's rising now is the timing. If you notice, Mr. St. Clair said that this could be a time-consuming process. And that, of course, may be a tip-off that the White House may seek to delay. It may say that it can't get together all the materials. And, of course, this could affect the entire impeachment process. But the members that we've had a chance to talk to here have all said that they want no delay in these proceedings, that they do want the proceedings to continue. And if new evidence is made available to the House Judiciary Committee or to the full House, they can be inserted into the record. So as far as we've been able to discern, the general feeling is that this should not delay the proceedings. Now, I understand that there have been some members who have said that they may try to delay them, but I think the general consensus is no. They're just going to carry on regardless. Back to you now, Jim.
Carolyn, there's another question which I would like to put to you. Carolyn, are you still there?
Yes.
I would like to ask you whether there is any indication from some of the Republican members, perhaps, that the president might now go a step further and turn over the tapes or copies of the tapes or transcripts to the Judiciary Committee as well. One of the leading Republican members on that committee, as you know, is Charles Wiggins of California, and he has suggested only today that perhaps the White House might do this. Is there any indication that this might be done?
Paul, we've had no indication of that, but there was something very interesting that happened about a half an hour ago here. That is before St. Clair actually spoke, so it's over a half an hour. The Vice President, Gerald Ford, looking very, very grim, came to the Hill and came upstairs just one floor above where I'm standing right now, and he went into the office of Congressman Glenn Davis and there met with a number of Republican members of the House Judiciary Committee. Now, nobody is saying exactly what the Vice President said, but he was looking very, very grim. Now, it may have been an offer of more information. At this point, I'm afraid we just can't tell. There hasn't been time to pin that one down, but we'll work on it.
Carolyn, well, thank you, Carolyn. We'll be coming back to you in just a moment. I'd like to say that the chairman of the committee, Peter Rodino, is now taking his seat, and we expect him momentarily to bang the gavel, which means that tonight's historic debate will be getting underway momentarily. We see that most of the committee members now appear to have taken their seats.
Yes, please, sir.
Chairman Rodino.
Donahoe and Nuwana.
Paul, I think we need to point out very quickly that the fact that these tapes and documents will be turned over to the federal court, there still could be a process by which is still undecided as to how they would finally get to the House Judiciary Committee. I mean, the fact that they're going to the court does not automatically mean that they're going to the House Judiciary Committee. That would have to be resolved as it goes along.
Yes. I think the point that Congressman Wiggins was making today, Jim, was that he hoped the White House might voluntarily turn over the tapes at the same time that he was providing the information for the courts as well. In other words, this would be an indication that the White House was now willing to provide more evidence to the Judiciary Committee.
And of course, this would lend great impetus, I would think, to delaying this particular process until those tapes have been given to the committee through one way or another, and they've had a chance to review them before they would go to this step of debating and voting on the articles of impeachment. It'll be interesting to see if Wiggins, particularly, who has been the president's primary defender on the, and the most articulate, I would say, too, defender of the president on the committee, makes a strong effort tonight to delay it on that basis. As Carolyn just said, there will be, some effort along that line. Depends on how serious it is.
We're still waiting for the proceedings to get underway, and it appears that they will start momentarily.
Get in here.
Mr. Rodino apparently now is waiting for the room to be cleared of photographers and cameramen who have been in to get just one more picture, as always. On either side of Mr. Rodino, there is Democratic Congressman Donahue of Massachusetts, and the ranking Republican, Mr. Hutchinson of Michigan, is on the other side.
To review what Carolyn laid out earlier, the current plan is for Chairman Rodino to make an opening statement followed by Mr. Hutchinson and then follow seniority on a Democratic-Republican alternating basis from that point on. That is what they call a poised gavel, Paul.
That's a holding pattern.
Want to get a gander at one end? got a four-page statement. Well, I don't know what anybody's going to say.
Chairman Rodino, of course, is a liberal Democrat from New Jersey, believed to be a sure vote for impeachment. There is John Doerr, man on the right in the lighter suit and glasses, who is the staff counsel for the Democratic side. To his right was Sam Garris, who is the new minority counsel replacing Albert Jenner a few days ago. Repeat, to continue on Peter Rodino, he is considered a sure vote for impeachment.
The committee
here we go.
Will come to order. Before I begin, I hope you will allow me a personal reference. Throughout all of the painstaking proceedings of this committee, I, as the chairman, have been guided by a simple principle. The principle that the law must deal fairly with every man. For me, this is the oldest principle of democracy. It is this simple but great principle which enables man to live justly and in decency in a free society. It is now almost 15 centuries since the Emperor Justinian, from whose name the word justice is derived, established this principle for the free citizens of Rome. 7 centuries have now passed since the English barons proclaimed the same principle by compelling King John at the point of a sword to accept the great doctrine of Magna Carta, the doctrine that the king, like each of his subjects, was under God and the law. Almost 2 centuries ago, the founding fathers of the United States reaffirmed and refined this principle so that here all men are under the law and it is only the people who are sovereign. So speaks our Constitution. And it is under our Constitution, the supreme law of our land, that we proceed through the sole power of impeachment. We have reached the moment when we are ready to debate resolutions, whether or not the Committee on the Judiciary should recommend that the House of Representatives adopt articles calling for the impeachment of Richard M. Nixon. Make no mistake about it. This is a turning point. Whatever we decide, our judgment is not concerned with an individual, but with a system of constitutional government. It has been the history and the good fortune of the United States ever since the founding fathers that each generation of citizens and their officials have been, within tolerable limits, faithful custodians of the Constitution and of the rule of law. For almost 200 years, every generation of Americans has taken care to preserve our system and the integrity of our institutions against the particular pressures and emergencies to which every time is subject. This committee must now decide a question of the highest constitutional importance. For more than 2 years, there have been serious allegations by people of good faith and sound intelligence that the president, Richard M. Nixon, has committed grave and systematic violations of the Constitution. Last October, in the belief that such violations had in fact occurred, a number of impeachment resolutions were introduced by members of the House and referred to our committee by the Speaker. On February 6th, the House of Representatives, by a vote of 410-4, authorized and directed the Committee on the Judiciary to investigate whether sufficient grounds exist to impeach Richard M. Nixon, President of the United States. The Constitution specifies that the grounds for impeachment shall be not partisan consideration, but evidence of treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. Since the Constitution vests the sole power of impeachment in the House of Representatives, it falls to the Judiciary Committee to understand even more precisely what high crimes and misdemeanors might mean in terms of the Constitution and the facts before us in our time. The Founding Fathers clearly did not mean that a president might be impeached for mistakes, even serious mistakes, which he might commit in the faithful execution of his office. By high crimes and misdemeanors, they meant offenses more definitely incompatible with the Constitution. The Founding Fathers, with their recent experience of monarchy and their determination that government be accountable and lawful, wrote into the Constitution a special oath that the president and only the president must take at his inauguration. And in that oath, the president swears that he will take care that the laws be faithfully executed. The Judiciary Committee has for 7 months investigated whether or not the president has seriously abused his power in violation of that oath and the public trust embodied in it. We have investigated fully and completely what within our Constitution and traditions would be grounds for impeachment. For the past 10 weeks, we have listened to the presentation of evidence in documentary form, to tape recordings of 19 presidential conversations, and to the testimony of 9 witnesses called before the entire committee. We have provided a fair opportunity for the president's counsel to present the views of the president to this committee. We have taken care to preserve the integrity of the process in which we are now engaged. We have deliberated. We have been patient. We have been fair. Now the American people, the House of Representatives, and the Constitution and the whole history of our republic demand that we make up our minds. As the English statesman Edmund Burke said during an impeachment trial in 1788, it is by this tribunal that statesmen who abuse their power are accused by statesmen and tried by statesmen, not upon the niceties of a narrow jurisprudence, but upon the enlarged and solid principles of state morality. Under the Constitution and under our authorization from the House of Representatives, this inquiry is neither a court of law nor a partisan proceeding. It is an inquiry which must result in a decision, a judgment based on facts, which must stand for all time. In his statement of April 30th, 1972, President Nixon told the American people that he had been deceived by subordinates into believing that none of the members of his administration or his personal campaign committee were implicated in the Watergate break-in, and that none had participated in efforts to cover up that illegal activity. A critical question this committee must now decide is whether the president was deceived by his closest political associates or whether they were in fact carrying out his policies and decisions. This question must be decided one way or the other. It must be decided whether the president was deceived by his subordinates into believing that his personal agents and key political associates had not been engaged in a systematic cover-up of the illegal political intelligence operation, of the identities of those responsible, and of the existence and scope of other related activities affecting the rights of citizens of these United States, or whether, in fact, Richard M. Nixon, in violation of the sacred obligation of his constitutional oath, has used the power of his high office for 2 years to cover up and conceal responsibility for the Watergate burglary and other activities of a similar nature. In short, the committee has to decide whether in his statement of April 30th and other public statements, the president was telling the truth to the American people, or whether that statement and other statements were part of a pattern of conduct designed not to take care that the laws were faithfully executed, but to impede their faithful execution for his political interest and on his behalf. There are other critical questions that must be decided. We must decide whether the president abused his power in the execution of his office. The great wisdom of our founders entrusted this process to the collective wisdom of many men. Each of those chosen to toil for the people at the great forge of democracy, the House of Representatives, has a responsibility to exercise independent judgment. I pray that we will each act with the wisdom that compels us in the end to be but decent men who seek only the truth. Let us be clear about this. No official, no concerned citizen, no representative, no member of this committee welcomes an impeachment proceeding. No one welcomes the day when there has been such a crisis of concern that he must decide whether high crimes and misdemeanors, serious abuses of official power or violations of public trust have in fact occurred. Let us also be clear. Our own public trust, our own commitment to the Constitution is being put to the test. Such tests, historically, have come to the awareness of most peoples too late, when their rights and freedoms under law were already so far in jeopardy and eroded that it was no longer in the people's power to restore constitutional government by democratic means. So let us go forward. Let us go forward into this debate with goodwill, with honor and decency, and with respect for the views of one another. Whatever we now decide, we must have the integrity and the decency, the will and the courage to decide rightly. Let us leave the Constitution as unimpaired for our children as our predecessors left it for us. I now recognize the gentleman from Michigan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I certainly agree with the opening paragraphs of your statement, and I want to compliment you upon a statement in which I'm sure you hold strong and firm belief. Although I would disagree with parts of it, I certainly wanted to say that I certainly compliment you upon its opening several paragraphs. We now proceed to consider the large mass of evidentiary material which was assembled during many months and presented to us by committee staff and by the testimony of witnesses who appeared before us. During the next few days, we will be weighing the evidence and acting upon it. After a period of general debate, we will be discussing amendments and voting upon them. And finally, the end product of our deliberations will be manifest. Either we shall, by majority vote, have recommended one or more grounds for impeachment against the president, or all of those proposed for adoption will have been defeated. In our deliberations, the people will have an unusual glimpse into the discussions of those charged with decision-making in a unique judicial process. But perhaps ours is more of a political than a judicial function after all. The fact is that, of course, judges and juries deliberate behind closed doors. But by the committee's action in opening these discussions, it has in effect determined that our function is more political than judicial. I think the public should know that until now, the only decisions made by this committee have been procedural ones. No substantive matter has yet been resolved. Early in the inquiry, the staff submitted a memorandum on what constitutes an impeachable offense within the meaning of the Constitution. But the committee took no action upon it, it being recognized that no definition could be drawn which would be agreed to, probably by most members. Thus, as of this minute, the committee has not resolved just what an impeachable offense is. As the staff assembled evidence, many of us thought that the committee should decide and give some direction to the staff as to the scope of the inquiry. We thought the committee should direct the staff into those areas of inquiry in which the committee itself determined that there might be merit, so that time and effort would not be consumed in frivolous or otherwise non-meritorious allegations. But such a course of action would have required the committee to make decisions of substance, and no decisions were made. The articles of impeachment which are to be exhibited tonight are, like any legislative bill, merely a vehicle upon which the committee may work its will. They will be open to additions, to deletions, amendments, and substitutions. Each member of this committee, individually weighing the evidence against his own concept of what warrants impeachment, will come to his own conclusion on how he votes on the articles in their final form. Each of us is struck by the enormity of the decision that we're called upon to make. As I see it, and I state only my personal views, a vote for an article of impeachment means that a member is convinced that the article states an offense for which the president should be removed from office, and that there is evidence which supports the charge beyond a reasonable doubt. Unlike criminal jurisprudence, where there is discretion in the court to make the sentence fit the crime, the Constitution mandates that conviction on impeachment shall carry with it removal from office, nothing less. It seems to me, then, that in determining in my own mind whether a specific charge states an impeachable offense, I would have to decide whether I thought the offense charge is of sufficient gravity to warrant removal of the president from office because of it. In other words, some offenses may be charged for which there is convincing evidence, and still such offenses may not, in the judgment of a member, be so serious as to justify impeachment and removal of a president of the United States from office. Earlier today, the Supreme Court announced that the president of the United States is required by law to comply with a certain subpoena ducis tecum served upon him in the case of the United States versus Mitchell and others by submission of the subpoenaed material to the trial judge for his private examination, and that the judge shall deliver to the prosecutor only those portions which are relevant to the case, returning the balance of the documentation to the president without disclosing its content. Since this committee has requested the tapes of the same conversations from the president and then subpoenaed them, the question arises whether our committee should proceed further until the availability of the additional evidence to the committee is determined. Many members on this side, Mr. Chairman, feel strongly that we should not. We believe the American people will expect us to examine and weigh all available evidence before we decide the momentous and most difficult issue before us. Even now, Mr. Chairman, we hope that the chair will consider whether, in view of the events of today, the committee ought not first to determine to postpone consideration of articles of impeachment until the evidence now to become available through the court can be made available to this committee.
I recognize the gentleman from Massachusetts, Mr. Donohoe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Pursuant to the procedural resolution which this committee adopted yesterday, I move that the committee report to the House a resolution together with articles of impeachment impeaching Richard M. Nixon, President of the United States. Now, a copy of this resolution is at the clerk's desk, and I understand a copy is also before each member.
I recognize the gentleman from Massachusetts for the purpose of general debate on his resolution for not to exceed 15 minutes, and every other member of the committee will be recognized for purposes of debate not to exceed 15 minutes following Mr. Donohue's presentation. Mr. Donohue.
Thank you again, Mr. Chairman. This historic debate and the motion I have just offered to this committee have their roots in the most fundamental precept of free men, that no individual is above the law. On July 20th, 1787, the Constitutional Convention had before it the great question, quote, shall the executive be removable on impeachment? Mr. Governor Morris, a delegate to that convention, spoke out forcibly in opposition. He wanted no impeachment clause in the draft of our Constitution. But he listened intently, as first Benjamin Franklin and then James Madison argued on behalf of such a clause. And finally, just before the question was voted, Mr. Governor Morris announced that his opinion had been changed by the arguments presented in debate. The impeachment clause was adopted by the convention and became Section 4 of Article 2 of the Constitution of the United States. And the sole power of impeachment was vested in the House of Representatives under Article 1, Section 2 of the Constitution. Now, pursuant to that constitutional power, House Resolution 803, as stated by our distinguished chairman, was adopted by the House of Representatives on February 6th by a vote of 410-4. That resolution directed this committee to investigate fully and completely whether sufficient grounds exist for the House of Representatives to exercise its constitutional authority to impeach the President of the United States. For the past several months, as has also been stated, this committee has been continuously engaged in the careful conduct of this presidential impeachment inquiry. Under the absolute neutral leadership, I believe that our chairman has well established its overriding motivation of honesty, decency, thoroughness, and objectivity to the satisfaction of the great majority of the American citizens. Now, in truth, there were and there are no positive material instruments available to us, such as those by which we can measure a precise distance or pronounce the exact time of day, to guarantee the errorless performance of this duty. The human means through which we must try to make the right measurement of conduct that is required in this historical task exists only in the individual minds and consciences of each of the committee members. These are the basic resources by which each determines the substance and the culpability of and in the evidence related to the several allegations that in the course of the official conduct of his office, President Richard M. Nixon engaged in certain activities designed to obstruct justice, to unlawfully invade the constitutional rights of private citizens, to refuse compliance with the duly authorized and properly served subpoenas of a committee of the Congress, to misuse executive agencies for personal and political benefit, and that President Richard M. Nixon in other and diverse ways failed to fulfill his constitutional obligations to ensure the faithful execution of our laws. Now the awesome constitutional duty of each member of this committee is to make an impartial determination as to whether or not the evidence before us warrants a reasonable judgment that Richard M. Nixon, as president, has seriously, gravely, purposefully, and persistently abused and misused the power entrusted in him by the people of these United States. Mr. Chairman, in my conviction, the hour for this decision has arrived. To this end, I believe the time has come to report to the House such resolutions, articles of impeachment, or other recommendations as we deem proper. On these enormous matters, I have carefully observed the witnesses who appeared before this committee, heard their testimony, listened to the summation of counsel on both sides, and I have fully studied all of the evidence. Mr. Chairman, I am most willing to listen to any further debate that may develop on the impeachment articles. I am prepared to vote on this momentous question before us. And I can but simply say this. My vote will be conscientiously cast in what I most sincerely believe is in the best interest of my country. I reserve the balance of my time, Mr. Chairman.
Chairman, the gentleman is advised that while he has 15 minutes remaining, the rule has, while he has 15 minutes, the chair has to state that according to the proceedings and according to the policy that we have adopted, that no time would be reserved. And therefore, I now recognize the gentleman from Illinois, Mr. McClory, for 15 minutes for purposes of debate only.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I judge from the remarks of the gentleman from Massachusetts that indeed he has come to a resolution of this momentous question that's before us. Nevertheless, Mr. Chairman, let me express the view that this impeachment inquiry undertaken by our House Judiciary Committee has been both historic and honorable. Impeachment is, of course, a political process, both political in the sense of governmental action and political in that it involves partisan interests and views. It would be the grossest understatement on my part to suggest that Watergate and all that that word implies has not caused serious injury to my party, the Republican Party. And this is so despite the fact that no element of our established Republican Party organization was involved, and no Republican member of the Congress has in any way been implicated in this whole affair. Let me assert, on the contrary, that Republicans, even more than Democrats, are anxious to erase this blemish from our party. I've heard it said by some that they cannot understand how a Republican could vote to impeach a Republican president. Let me hasten to assert that that argument demeans my role here. It would infer that no matter what high crimes and misdemeanors might have been committed, that if attributable to a Republican president, then I, as a Republican, am foreclosed from judging the merits of the case. I cannot and do not envision my role in that dim light. As a purely partisan matter, would it enhance our Republican Party if, despite the evidence and the weight of constitutional law, we as Republicans on this side of the aisle decide to exonerate a Republican president accused of high crimes and misdemeanors simply because he and we are Republicans? I see that line as leading to Republican Party disaster. A viable two-party system, to my mind, is an institution worthy of preserving, second only to our constitutional system of checks and balances. Preserving our Republican Party does not, to my mind, imply that we must preserve and justify a man in office who would deliberately and arbitrarily defy the legal processes of the Congress, nor can our party be enhanced if we, as Republican members of the United States House of Representatives, tolerate the flouting of our laws by a president who is constitutionally charged with seeing that the laws are faithfully executed as provided in Article 2. We will enhance our Republican Party and assure a viable two-party system only if we are courageous enough and wise enough to reject such conduct, even if attributed to a Republican president. The essential question which we must answer is not what is best for our party, but what is best for our nation. While the investigation has been far-reaching and has, in my opinion, delved into some peripheral areas, I cannot help but recognize that on the major subjects which have been investigated, the work of the committee and of our committee staff has been both objective and bipartisan. I would like particularly to observe that we've been assisted by able counsel and to make a general observation that the members of the minority staff, the Republican staff, have contributed substantially to the overall work product of our inquiry. Despite our partisan differences, I would add that you, Mr. Chairman, have, in general, been very fair with the minority. The American public need have no fear that the Republican interests have not been ably and appropriately served by our ranking member, Mr. Ed Hutchinson of Michigan, and by my other distinguished and able colleagues who sit on the Republican side in this committee room. I shall turn at once to the main subject of our inquiry, namely the numerous allegations of wrongdoing charged against the President of the United States, all of which allegations we have investigated over a period of many months for the purpose of ascertaining whether or not President Nixon should be charged with the commission of an impeachable offense. The most serious allegations, and those upon which the President's accusers have placed principal reliance, go under the general title of Watergate and cover-up. Our majority counsel, Mr. Dorr, in interpreting the information before us, has expounded the thesis that the President organized and managed the Watergate cover-up from the time of the break-in on June 17, 1972, up until the present time. While serious questions exist regarding the President's authorization or acquiescence in an obstruction of justice, a conclusion which might be reached from examining the transcripts of taped conversations and other evidence, the thesis advanced by Mr. Dorr that the President was in charge of a cover-up from the time of the break-in is, in my opinion, unjustified in the light of the evidence presented to our committee. Our chief minority counsel, the able Mr. Sam Garrison, made an important and extremely significant point in his final summation of the Watergate evidence. He said, Mr. Dorr's case of circumstances showing presidential involvement from the beginning is a very, very weak one. Because you cannot simply aggregate suspicions, you cannot aggregate inferences upon inferences, you can only aggregate facts. Watergate is a serious matter. Many in and out of the White House have been involved in this tragic episode. But while voluminous evidence has been produced, I question seriously that it is of the clear and convincing nature that should impel us to indict the President on a charge of cover-up or obstruction of justice. Instead, the case against the President rests upon circumstantial evidence, inferences, innuendos, and a generous measure of wishful thinking on the part of some who would indict the President even without adequate proof of wrongdoing in the Watergate affair. Now, in the light of today's Supreme Court decision, there may be indeed other available evidence to the committee within the next few days or weeks. Substantial additional evidence from the White House tapes upon which this committee can better judge the guilt or innocence of the President in the whole Watergate affair. The doctrine of absolute executive privilege upon which the President and his counsel relied has been substantially rejected by the Supreme Court. And we can expect, hopefully, that we will get promptly and without equivocation from the White House the additional tapes, which we also subpoenaed and which are now under the President's decision to be made available to the special prosecutor. And we also have the mechanism for excising those irrelevant parts which might not be appropriate for us to see. Although on the basis of evidence thus far received, the case involving Watergate has been less than convincing, there are other subjects which the facts, in which the facts are virtually undisputed and where the only settled, unsettled question is whether or not an impeachable offense has been committed under the Constitution to which I made reference. If the extremely serious subject of Watergate results nevertheless in a weak case against the direct involvement of the President, this should not be construed to mean that there has been no wrongdoing in the White House. Watergate and the alleged cover-up involves the offense of obstruction of justice, for instance, payments of hush money, inducing witnesses to commit perjury, and others. These offenses have been committed at the White House or by the President's most intimate aides and friends. But if the President is not personally and criminally liable because the evidence does not directly and personally implicate him, nevertheless, we may appropriately ask, has the President fulfilled his obligation to see to a faithful execution of the laws, a solemn obligation imposed by the Constitution? This obligation is above and beyond that of other citizens, all of whom are required to obey the laws. We may ask further, is the office of the presidency being operated in the manner contemplated by the Constitution when, under the guise of national security, dissatisfaction with the head of the FBI, or personal animosity against enemies, we experience burglaries, wiretaps, bugging unlawfully provided, shredding and concealment of evidence, misuse of the CIA, FBI, IRS, and a host of other misdeeds? It should not be hard for my solid Midwest constituents, Republicans, Democrats, and independents alike, to see and understand what's troubling me. Believe me, it's also troubling them. The question remains whether these acts and omissions of Richard Nixon as president are to be approved or denounced. If in these respects the president is to be denounced, and if the president is to be called to account for such acts and omissions, impeachment is the appropriate and constitutionally designated vehicle for bringing these specific charges against him. What about the offenses committed by Haldeman, Ehrlichman, Colson, LaRue, Dean, and others? There is substantial authority for attributing their misconduct to the president in a strictly legal sense and require him to account for their offenses. But there is the higher constitutional obligation to see that such criminal acts are not committed or condoned. A constitutional demand to see that the laws are obeyed, particularly in the president's own house, which we call the White House. After receiving evidence for weeks and weeks, evidence which has been frequently peripheral as it relates to direct involvement of the president in Watergate and other crimes, I ask myself, is this any way to run a White House or a country? Finally, the clearest and most convincing issue before us, and one which is perhaps more fundamental to our inquiry, is that of the committee's subpoenas, in which we requested information from the president. Fundamental to the entire impeachment inquiry is his obligation to provide us with the information which we require so that we can perform our role. We do want a strong chief executive, but we also want a Congress which is given full recognition, as well as the courts. Likewise, it's essential that the president respect that part of the Constitution which vests in the House the sole power of impeachment. The House Judiciary Committee, as the designated unit of the House of Representatives, is endeavoring to fulfill that role with honor and dignity consistent with our responsibilities. In this particular time in our history, we demand a Congress capable of exercising not only its lawmaking authority, but also its power of the oversight function, which includes that of the extraordinary authority of impeachment. Earlier this year, the President promised full cooperation with our inquiry, consistent with his responsibilities to the office of the presidency. But despite that pledge, the only materials which we've received have come from the grand jury and from the special prosecutor. except some that have accidentally fallen into our hands. On May 30, we sent the president a letter advising him what the consequences were of his failure to comply. We said, in meeting our constitutional responsibility, the committee members will be free to consider whether your refusals in and of themselves might constitute a ground for impeachment. The committee has taken this stand because of the president's noncompliance with the committee's subpoenas, a defiance of the powers of the Congress, and impairing our ability to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. In this sense, it seems to me the president's failure to comply threatens the integrity of our impeachment process itself. His action is a direct challenge to the Congress in the exercise of its solemn constitutional duty. These, then, are the issues which are disturbing me as we approach this final phase of our assignment under the House resolution authorizing this comprehensive impeachment inquiry, which my colleagues and I have been conducting, and which we must resolve deliberately and responsibly within the next few days. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I recognize, for purposes of general debate, only the gentleman from Texas, Mr. Brooks, not to exceed 15 minutes.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. This committee has heard evidence of governmental corruption unequaled in the history of the United States. The cover-up of crimes, obstructing the prosecution of criminals, surreptitious entries, wiretapping for political purposes, suspension of the civil liberties of every American, tax violations and personal enrichment at public expense, bribery and blackmail, flagrant misuse of the FBI, the CIA, and the IRS. 18 individuals have been convicted or pleaded guilty, and 6 have been indicted for criminal activities directly related to Mr. Nixon's re-election efforts or activities which originated within the White House. These individuals are not obscure government officials, but include cabinet officers, personal assistants, the closest personal advisors to Richard Nixon. Never in our 198 years have we had evidence of such rampant corruption in government. We must decide whether this corruption attached to the president, whether there is evidence that the president, by his actions or inaction, failed in his constitutional responsibility to faithfully execute the law. We on the committee, both Republicans and Democrats, have taken our constitutional responsibility most seriously and have pursued the facts, often without the cooperation of those possessing information, and at times in the face of planned efforts to mislead and divert us from the truth. It is our constitutional duty to determine whether there is sufficient cause to bring Richard Nixon before the United States Senate for trial and removal from office. In resolving this issue, we should put aside the legalistic jargon of our profession, present to the American people in plain language our best judgment as to whether there is evidence that Richard Nixon has brought disgrace and disrespect to the office of president. We must immediately put to rest the argument that the corruption we have witnessed in the last 5 years is only an extension of what has always been done. I do not share this view, or the view of those who hold that all presidents have lied, have broken the law, have compromised the Constitution. And if George Washington accepted bribes, it would not make bribery a virtue, nor would it be grounds for overlooking such acts by his successor. There is no political gain for anyone or any political party in this procedure. If ever there was a time to put aside partisanship, now is that time. There would be no Democratic gain from removing a Republican president and having him replaced by another Republican who could represent and might well receive a great outflowing of support from our people. We must now report to the House of Representatives and the American people our conclusions as to whether there is sufficient evidence that Richard Nixon, while serving as president, has violated his oath of office and has thereby jeopardized our constitutional system of government. This is not a pleasant duty, but it is our constitutional duty. Its performance may mean ignoring personal and political relationships of long standing. But we, as well as the president, are on trial for how faithfully we fulfill our constitutional responsibilities. I want to thank the chairman for recognizing me, and in the interest of expediting this resolution of this very difficult problem, yield the remainder of my time.
Recognize the gentleman from New York, Mr. Smith, for not to exceed 15 minutes for purposes of debate only.
Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen of the committee, I know that we all feel the weight of the historic action we are about to take. After months of diligent inquiry into the question of whether or not the President of the United States should be impeached, it is a solemn duty we have undertaken pursuant to the requirements of the Constitution of the United States. How we decide here, how the House of Representatives may decide if we recommend impeachment, how the Senate may resolve the issue if the House shall vote impeachment of the President, are decisions which will affect our nation in one way or another for the rest of time. I take this opportunity, Mr. Chairman, of expressing my respect for the other 37 lawyer members of this committee who have borne the grueling work of this inquiry for months. And I take this opportunity also to express my respect for and my thanks to the members of the impeachment inquiry staff and the regular staff members of this committee for the dedicated professional jobs each and every one of them has done during this historic project. The massive amount of information, documents, testimony, and legal precedents they have gathered, assimilated, organized, and presented with skill during these months of this inquiry are almost beyond belief. The constitutional duty of this committee in regard to impeachment, possibly that of the House and possibly that of the Senate, always a sad duty, is a particularly sad one here, in that it contemplates the possible impeachment and conviction of a president who has ended our direct participation in a bitter and divisive war which was not of his making, and who, history may show, has done more than any person now living to bring about peace and brotherhood in this world through his bold initiatives in establishing communication and bases for understanding with other powerful nations and other powerful peoples, and through his initiatives carried out by the painstaking and tireless work of dedicated aides in creating the climate for and the support of a real ceasefire in the Middle East and now in Cyprus. But even so, if this president has also been guilty of treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors, as it is stated in the Constitution, then it is the constitutional duty of the House of Representatives to impeach him, and the constitutional duty of the Senate to convict him. To determine whether there are valid grounds for impeachment has been the duty of this committee. We have a resolution and articles of impeachment before us, and we have for months examined mountains of evidence and listened to witnesses. There is here no charge of treason, so the question is, do we think the president is guilty of the charges of bribery or other high crimes and misdemeanors? The president says he is not. What measure or standard of evidence is necessary for this committee to say he is or may be guilty? I think it is something more than probable cause, which is sufficient for indictment by a grand jury, and something less than satisfaction beyond a reasonable doubt, which is required for conviction of a crime. Mr. St. Clair, the president's lawyer, has suggested a standard of clear and convincing proof. And Mr. Doar, the chief counsel of this committee's impeachment inquiry staff, appeared to endorse that standard. Except for one area, I am not satisfied that there has been produced before this committee clear and convincing proof of the president's personal involvement in actions which would be impeachable. The testimony is generally not solid and clear. It raises inference after inference, many negative ones against the president and some positive ones in his favor. But there is precious little solid, hard evidence of his personal, impeachable misdeeds. Except for the area of the secret bombing in Cambodia at the president's order between March 18, 1969 and May 1, 1970, where I have not yet made up my mind, I should have to vote against impeachment of the president on the state of the evidence which we have seen. This is why I was delighted today when the Supreme Court ruled 8-0 that the president must deliver the tapes and memoranda subpoenaed by Special Prosecutor Jaworski. I believe that this means that this committee will at last have this material available for inspection so we can determine once and for all whether the president is guilty of impeachable offenses or whether he is not. I think it is absolutely imperative that this committee make the effort to secure this evidence. I believe that any other course in the present state of the evidence before this committee would be self-defeating and not worthy of the effort which has already gone into this inquiry and investigation. I thank you, Mr. Chairman, for recognizing me, and if my understanding of a reservation of time as of yesterday afternoon is still valid, I reserve the balance of my time.
I'd like to advise the gentleman, as I advise the gentleman from Massachusetts, that the policy of the committee was enunciated yesterday that there is no reservation of time afforded to any member.